Well, I must first introduce Deirdre Heinan from Ulster University and Richard from the Queen's University. The last sentence of this beautiful song, "I can only pray for a bright, brand new day in the town I loved so well." Very short, before you go, and Erich will actually moderate the ongoing discussion, which we'll have together with the whole conference. But first, a first reaction. Are we going to see this kind of situations as described in this beautiful song again, or is this just forever past? Deirdre.
I hope and believe it's forever past. There is no appetite to return to the past. People have experienced normality and they will not go back to the past. That is not to say that a return to some sort of a hard border won't cause problems, difficulties, anxieties and threats, but I am absolutely sure that we will not return to the past.
Richard?
I'm an optimist, and I have to be, having worked here for nearly 50 years. But I do believe that the current crisis, it is a crisis over Brexit and the border, will be resolved in the end, because it has to be. In the same way as I believe that the government at Stormont, which has been out of office for now over a year, will be reconstituted because it has to be. And I don't see Northern Ireland going back to those dark days that we've talked about on the train up and yesterday again. And I generally think there will be a solution. Very briefly, I interviewed George Mitchell, who was the architect behind the Good Friday Agreement, and asked him, I said, "You face the impossible task of reconciling diametrically opposed opposites at Good Friday. How would you approach the problem of Brexit?" And he said, in exactly the same way.
I would agree with what Deirdre and Peter have said. Three quick things. One, I don't think there's any evidence that the conditions for a return to large-scale violence are here. The things which generated large-scale violence of the kind that Peter began reporting on years ago so well, I just don't think are there. Second point is that doesn't mean that there'll be no violence. I think what you have in the north is often a low-level turbulence, and I think we will continue to see that. There will be occasional lethal violence, and I think whether that goes up or down is up to us to try and determine, but it'll be on the margins. The third thing is this, and Peter mentioned George Mitchell and the 1998 Good Friday Agreement. If 20 or 30 years ago the problems we now face had been predicted, they would have seemed like quite good problems to have. I think that if people had said in the late 1980s, the problem you'll face is a largely peaceful Northern Ireland where the politicians are finding it difficult to get back into power sharing, that would have been seen as a positive set of problems. And I think we should keep sight of how much has been achieved in recent decades.
Well, let me just add a few words of my own experience as a reporter for Swiss television, which I was in those years when the troubles took place here. And when we traveled now from Dublin to Belfast, of course, sort of memories came back. And I mean, it's just unbelievable when we all said it, sitting in the same part of the train, looking to this beautiful landscape, to the peaceful landscape, to everything we see here, what has happened here. And when Peter and Martin, when they spoke about all these atrocities in those years, and you just can't believe it. And when I think back, I mean, I didn't realize many reports here, maybe a half a dozen or 10 at the maximum. It was just, of course, memories come back. And we also were here in this hotel. We were accommodated here in this hotel. And then we tried, of course, to explain to the Swiss audience what's going to happen here. And it was very difficult in those years to make it understandable, because everybody asked you in Switzerland, well, is it a religious, is it a sectarian a problem, what is it? And it's more complex. So we tried all the time to explain what it is, and we came back time and again. And We were in with my cameraman. I was in this famous church where Paisley, where Jan Paisley was preaching, and well, I still remember very well. We were there, and we had to hide the camera we had, and cameras were quite large things, large tools after all. So we were somewhere in a corner of the church, and Jan Paisley asked, "Are there any reporters here?" And of course, we kept quiet. And it's the last question. There's your last chance to say, "Is there any reporter here in this room?" And we kept quiet. And we could leave the church afterwards. And well, he followed us with his stick, and he threatened us with his stick, but we were sort of a little bit faster than he. So these memories, of course, come back, but mainly it's the consternation of seeing what people, what human beings can do to each other in a surrounding where you really can't, you can't expect it. It's not a situation where you would have said, well, it's clear you have two different sides and the war is imminent. No, it's always looked peaceful, just with the exception of when anything happened, then it was different, of course. Very strange, I must say. Well, I have the privilege of sort of moderating this panel here. But if you say the Swiss have to moderate a panel, we should laugh, because Swiss people are moderate anyhow. So what we should do, after all, is to animate. So we rather have to consider our job as being sort of animators here, as animators than moderators. But if I ask you first, Deirdre, how important is it for you, or how is it important for you and for people here right now, when they look back to the 70s and the 80s and maybe the 90s, what has happened there? Is the past really, has it passed by, or how do people feel about it?
Sorry, your question was, do we remember the violence of the past, how important is it? I think it's probably worth saying that we have the youngest population in Europe, and that many of our young people have no recollection of the violence. I have three teenage sons, 22, 20 and 18. They have no recollection of the violence in Northern Ireland. And when you talk about it, they roll their eyes in disbelief and say, "Oh no, she's off on a terrible rant again." Because they can't even imagine it, even though it happened here. So when you tell them about bombs and about how life was disrupted, they really can't understand it. And they're not really that interested in truth. They're interested in jobs. They're interested in their future. They're interested in traveling. The world is a global place. They're interested in what's happening across the world. So that memory doesn't exist for the generation post Good Friday Agreement. And I think that's important. But it's also important then that those of us who do remember it are ensuring that we can never go back, that people have an understanding about the divisions, about what it was like and about what happened. The Good Friday Agreement, we felt, was a guarantor of peace. And it's hard to overstate the euphoria that people of my generation felt when the Good Friday Agreement was signed, because we really believed it was the start of a bright, brand new future. Now, maybe looking back, I know, Peter, you said you're an optimist. Perhaps I think we were a little over-optimistic when the Good Friday Agreement was signed, because there were always going to be hurdles and barriers and difficulties when you were putting diametrically opposed people together in a government. It's also important to point out that the government that we had very little political capacity. They were not politicians and didn't understand, in my view, how to govern, how to make relationships, how to build trust. And we have a civil service that also wasn't modernised and didn't have the capacity to move society forward. So I think after the Good Friday Agreement, we should have been more resolved around issues such as reconciliation and tackling sectarianism. Those issues would have ensured that the things that we talked about, the violence, the identity politics, could have been more consigned to the past. The reality is those issues are very difficult, and our politicians, in their wisdom, decided not to tackle them. They were put in the box marked too difficult. So after the Good Friday Agreement, for example, I think there was a general belief that we would do something about the segregated nature of Northern Ireland, the fact that housing is segregated, and most fundamentally, in my view, the fact that our children from the age of four are separated into different education systems. It is not unusual for children in Northern Ireland to not meet until they're 18 years old to meet someone of the other tradition, Catholic or Protestant. That to me just simply reinforces divisions and ensures that stereotypes continue. Would you believe in Northern Ireland that our teachers are trained as either Catholic teachers or Protestant teachers? We have separate teacher training colleges that cost us a huge amount of public finance. I mean, you could simply couldn't imagine a situation where you said we're going to have doctors for the Catholic population and doctors for the Protestant population. It would seem outrageous. Yet we are sitting today, 20 years after the Good Friday Agreement, with an education system that is as divided as it ever was. So I think in terms of not going back, if we are serious about not going back, there are major policy transformations that have not happened that simply must happen. Of course, we don't have a devolved government at the moment. When the government collapsed, I think the British government had a choice. They could either call another election, but why would they? Because the result would be probably exactly the same as the previous one. Or they could introduce direct rule, which would not sit well with most people here. And also, the British government are preoccupied by Brexit, and the very last thing they want in their inbox is Northern Ireland, and having cabinet ministers to come to Northern Ireland and clutter up House of Commons times with Northern Ireland business. So the decision they made was to go for a sort of no man's land, pretend you still have devolved government, not institute direct rule, in the hope that the parties would come together and come and form a government again. That, I think, has been very damaging for Northern Ireland because we have been in a vacuum. And vacuums are always dangerous. At a time when Brexit is being discussed, probably the most important thing that has happened since the Good Friday Agreement, we have no representation from Northern Ireland. We know that there will be a devolved government again because there's simply no alternative. These parties will have to come together and form a government. So it is extraordinarily frustrating for people sitting like ourselves, knowing it's going to happen and really hoping that the governments would take a bigger role in ensuring that an agreement is found. Because that agreement will ensure, again, that we do not go back to the past. But it is the vacuum, I think, that people are worried about. The fact that we don't have direct rule and we also don't have a devolved government. And the rhetoric coming out of both of the main parties seems to be pushing them further apart rather than moving to any sort of conciliation. Sorry, I go on too long.
Martin, do you have a question to Dave?
Just to this point.
Suggest, yeah, okay. Just to this point.
Well, I don't know. Does this work?
Yes.
Yeah. Yep. Can I just push you a little bit on that point that the two governments should take more of an initiative?
Yeah.
I beg to differ.
Okay.
I think that since 1998, the two governments, in their best intentions, Blair and Ahern still at the time, rolled up their sleeves when there was a problem. They helicoptered into Stormont. They pushed heads together, allowing the local parties to be passive, not take responsibility for the process most of the time, and wait until they're kicked in the bum by either Dublin or London or both. And that has created an inertia by local politicians who sort of wash their hands as not being responsible for their own place. That, in my view, together with the limited calibre of the local politicians at the moment has led to this case where everybody just blames everybody, but nobody does anything.
I think it's a fair point, but I think if you look back over the last 20 years, there is no doubt that the two governments have been preoccupied by their own issues and Northern Ireland has been left to get on with it. Now, that may be okay if we were a mature democracy and we knew what we were doing. The reality is many of our politicians had absolutely no political experience, where you might say, well, then they have SPADs, special political advisors, to advise them. Those SPADs also had no political experience and didn't actually do the job that one might expect. Also, the system of government, the consociational system of government, is flawed, and the system was flawed. So, for example, the scrutiny that should have happened within the local government didn't happen because the chair of the health committee, for example, didn't scrutinise the health issues as the chair of the committee. The chair of the committee was always the Sinn Féin chair of the committee, who was not going to cause problems for their own minister. That's not how government was envisaged, and it didn't happen in that way. So policy decisions that should have been made were not made. So if I give you an example, our health service is in crisis. We've had nine major reports into our health service, all saying the same thing. What a surprise. We need to change. The system is not sustainable. Very briefly, we have too many hospitals and we don't have enough focus on care in the community, which is what people want in an ageing population. So our politicians knew what had to happen, but simply did not have the appetite nor the capacity to make the change. Unlike, for example, if you looked at policing, you might say that's an example of where change happened. It was planned and it happened. Health, it has not happened. Education, it has not happened. At what point would the governments have stepped in and said, you can't keep drifting along? Action. Action is required. So we had a lot of politics. We had notionally a government that was working, but very much a government that said, this is my fiefdom. I will make decisions largely that suit my community. And this is my portfolio. I will make decisions that suit my community. So really, if you examined it, to what extent has there ever been a shared vision as to what Northern Ireland needs to look like? You might say, can we ever have a shared vision when one political party wants to be part of the United Kingdom and the other wants to be part of the island of Ireland? Can they ever come to an agreement? My view is yes, they can, at least in the short term. The difficulty, and then I'm going to stop. The difficulty is we thought the constitutional question was settled after the Good Friday Agreement. Many Catholics living in Northern Ireland were quite content to live in Northern Ireland. In fact, would have chosen to live in Northern Ireland, valued the education system, valued the pension system, valued the National Health Service. It was only when it became apparent the levels of disrespect for the nationalist community, coupled with Brexit, that the whole constitutional question has been seriously reawakened. And people who were comfortable as Catholics living in the north of Ireland are now beginning to question that if there is to be a return to a border.
You mentioned that, and it was quite surprising for me that still today, in many families, young people, boys, girls, don't get an opportunity, or they don't see a possibility of meeting people from the other religious group, so Protestants, Catholics, not Protestants. This is very surprising for me. I thought these divisions should be overcome. Have overcome in the last 10 or 15 or 20 years. Richard, is this the same experience you have?
Absolutely, and it's a really important point. I think when people like yourselves who have interests in politics around the world are visiting Belfast, one of the things is to reflect on the things that might inform lessons for other places. And one of the things that Deirdre mentioned there, which is hugely important, is this. The peace in Northern Ireland is essentially a peace without reconciliation. So when people look and think that the peace happened because people were reconciled, absolutely not. The peace happened because of hard-headed decisions by people who realized the victory was not coming and compromise was essential. But the division between the two communities is very, very striking and stark. What Deirdre says is absolutely right. I work at Queen's University Belfast. I've worked there most of the last 30 years. It's more divided now than it was in the late 1980s. Why? And there's a very good reason for this. And when you're thinking about other conflicts and how they end, this is a very important point. 30 years ago, if people were to have an argument politically between the two groups, the consequences of that could be appalling. Okay, so I could have an argument with you about your side being to blame, and you could have an argument with me about my side being to blame. We'd switch the radio on, and someone would have been killed within walking distance. Whereas now, you can have division without the worst costs being paid. Okay, so what you have is a really interesting problem, and Deirdre alluded to this, and I think it's a very important point for other conflicts. Is the solution that you want to get rid of the division, or is that unrealistic? Is the solution that you really want to have peaceful division? Schooling, a lot of socializing, residential segregation, who gets married to who, even in some cases sport. Now, in some cases, everyone supports Manchester United, so there are some exceptions to this. I say this with regret as an Arsenal supporter, but you're right. No, people support Celtic or Rangers, or they support Cliftonville or Linfield, or the GAA, or to some extent other sports less like. So there is division in most areas of life. Okay, so one point is what we have is peace without reconciliation. But again, let's not forget, in many conflicts around the world, peace without reconciliation would be a great result. Okay, I gave a lecture in Israel not that long ago and was making this point about peace without reconciliation, to which someone said, that would be pretty good where I'm sitting. Another point which Deirdre made, which I want to reinforce, which I think again has implications for other conflicts, is this. The paradox of peace is that London, the government in London's main interest in the peace process was to stop the violence. And once the violence has substantially stopped, there's much less reason for people to get involved at prime ministerial level. So you get this lack of interest, partly born of the fact that it's peaceful. I rather agree with Deirdre. I think that if the politicians in London and Dublin became more muscularly involved, it would help. And I think they do have, in the case of the London government, they have ultimate responsibility as the state, which rules the place. In the case of the Dublin government, they have a long-standing and perfectly legitimate interest in the place, and I would rather see more involvement. There's a question here, one final point before. Quite often in conflicts like the Northern Ireland conflict and peace processes, like the Northern Ireland peace process, things that have nothing to do with the conflict or the peace process jump in ways that determine it. Okay, so in Irish history, the First World War transformed the Irish conflict 100 years ago. Okay, in the 1960s, the mixture of civil rights movements and student radicalism around the world had their echoes in Northern Ireland in particular cases. Brexit essentially has nothing particularly to do with the Northern Ireland politics, but it's transforming some of the terms of the debate. So there's a question there, yeah?
But how important within the...
Sorry.
Within the complex of these questions.
Sorry. As I have worked in several conflicts throughout the Soviet Union, I have a question exactly to that reconciliation period. It is not a very common tradition after conflict resolution to have a reconciliation process. And I'm wondering when is the right moment. From your experience, I tend to believe that it must be right after the end of, or after a kind of a settlement that can calm down. But there may also be something like, let people get used to normality and maybe then start something meaningful with some illuminated people on both sides over the possible steps you can take, because you can burn your best results by trying to do too much and reigniting the conflict again.
Peter and Deirdre will have a view on this too. My view briefly would be, I don't think you can accelerate reconciliation. I think you have to go with the rhythm of each setting. I also think that where there are doors that you can push open in terms of reconciliation, even if they're small gestures, they should be pushed open, because they may invest in trust for the future or forgiveness. But I also think it's important to remember, and again, this is crucial for other conflicts too, I think, this was a very intimate conflict. It was about 17 different local conflicts. The violence, if you look at it, was often in local cycles. So you and I might be targeting each other in the name of different national traditions, but we're also people who grew up five streets away, and quite possibly your granddad and my granddad were enemies as well. In other words, this was intimate, and those legacies of enmity, of hostility, are very close up, and they don't easily get removed. So I'm against people forcing the pace of an unrealistic reconciliation, because I think it might actually backfire. But Peter and Deirdre may have different views on that.
Peter, can you comment?
I think the thing about the peace, the important thing to remember about the peace that was effectively established by the Good Friday Agreement, was that the peace was a peace meaning the absence of violence. And that's what underlines, you know, all that we are saying. We now take for granted the fact that the violence through which, you know, we all lived over, you know, 30, 40 years is no more. Yes, there is still a threat of violence from a relatively small, hardcore dissident group. But the past that we do not wish to return to was a past of violence. And I think the reason why we were able, or George Mitchell and the relevant parties, were able to establish the Good Friday Agreement was partly because the British government was involved, picking up what Deirdre has said and Richard has said, that as far as the British are concerned, the tendency with regard to Ireland, and this goes way back to the days of civil rights when you know, Westminster politicians knew what was going on the other side of the Irish Channel, but didn't want to get involved. It was only at moments of crisis when politicians came involved because they had to be and move the thing on. The peace process really was the result, and the ending of violence was the result of politicians in London and ultimately in Dublin in getting involved in a process secretly to persuade the IRA and also their opposite numbers on the loyalist side to stop killing each other. And that was the great triumph, and that's what took the time, and that is the key lesson to ending conflict, to ending violent conflicts. You cannot do anything as long as the participants in that conflict agree to, well, not initially lay down their arms, but agree to work towards a peaceful solution. And that takes a long, long time. The peace process in Northern Ireland goes way back to 1971, when our intelligence service, MI6, got involved and tried through its auspices, secretly, covertly, to try and persuade the IRA to stop its campaign. And if you look at the subsequent, 30 years, those secret talks went on until finally they reached a conclusion when the IRA was persuaded by the British government that the British government had no objection to United Ireland, but it had to be achieved via peaceful means. The penny finally dropped in the IRA boxes, and they were prepared to move towards a remarkable accommodation. But on the same side, because it takes two or three sides to make war,
on the loyalist side, because loyalist violence was largely reactive to IRA violence. You kill us, you kill our policemen, you kill our prison officers, you kill our civilians, and we will retaliate. So the fact that the loyalists were also persuaded to put down their arms, largely through the intervention of the Protestant clergy, concomitant with the IRA's decision to call a ceasefire, was the foundations for the peace. And although, you know, I agree with what, you know, Deirdre says and what Richard says, there is a huge amount left to be desired about the peace. The key thing about the peace is, with the notable exception of the possible problem from the dissidents ready to exploit Brexit and a hard border, by and large, there is still the absence of violence. And that, I think, is the thing to be celebrated, that we must hold on to, and why we must not take any risk of going back. And that risk, although tenuous, I think would be increased, exacerbated, were there to be a hard border.
I'm actually interested in this discussion because precisely what you said, other conflicts, Yemen, for instance. And I found it interesting that you mention peace without reconciliation, absence of violence. Now, if I look at this specific conflict in Yemen, north or south, you will see that communal identities have been responsible for recurring violence. So you have periods where we had peace agreements, and then everybody was happy. But then these identities and the fact that one did not address the grievances in a manner that brings trust has led also to this recurring violence. So from my perspective, isn't it a little bit a realist approach? Maybe we cannot make them one nation. Would this really lead to absence of violence? Because from what you were describing, it's just a matter of time before this again happens. And again, another question related to what you were saying. You asked about when we start with the reconciliation. My question to you, what were the measures that you would have seen in this respect? If you had to do it again.
Okay. I think what had become increasingly apparent before the collapse of our government is that we could not ignore the past. The past is difficult, the past is contested, but we hadn't addressed it. And really, everyday politics couldn't go on as normal, as it were, because the past continually came to the future and interrupted the so-called normalization of life. So, for example, we hadn't had a mechanism. Some were suggested, but not enacted, as to how we would deal with the past. Yes, we looked around at other conflicts, looked at truth commissions, looked at what had happened in other countries. But again, the truth is a contested concept, as you know. I think what happened in Northern Ireland is because we didn't have an agreed system of addressing the past and addressing the conflict, the system that evolved was very ad hoc. So people went through the coroner's courts, we had inquests, we had inquiries, but they all tended to be inquiries and inquests about state killings. Therefore, the unionist community began to think there was a rewriting of history, that their story wasn't being told, that their truth wasn't fully understood. And because it was ad hoc, and because we couldn't agree away, the piecemeal system that evolved in Northern Ireland actually caused huge amount of difficulty, uncertainty, hurt and anger. So in response to your question, I don't know when the ideal time is to start that process. But I think we waited possibly too long, because it's not as if in those intervening two decades, nothing happened. Other things were happening, as I say, such as inquests. We had the huge Bloody Sunday inquiry. We've had calls for other inquiries. We've had the coroner's court making calls around a reopening inquest. So things were happening, but not in a planned way, not in a way that was underlined by principles that said this is about reconciliation. This is about an understanding that some people just want to know what happened to their loved ones. Other people want to know what happened to their loved ones, and they want justice. And a realization that as people are getting older, memories are fading, and the actual opportunity of ever finding that truth and knowing what really happened becomes dimmer with every passing day. And people are beginning to face the fact that they may never know and feel very angry about that.
I think that's all part of the problem of reconciliation. And the Unionist case, the Protestant case, the Loyalist case, which has never really been fully recognised by those who cover the conflict, is the result of the sort of alienation now of the Protestant Unionist Loyalist community, who now feel the underdogs in the same way as Catholics felt the underdogs at the time of civil rights. The tables have now turned. And the fact that the Unionist, Loyalist, Protestant community wants justice for those of its fellow Protestant citizens who cannot get justice for the murders that were committed by the IRA, is a constant deep, deep sore running within the Unionist community. One of the reasons why the government, the executive, fell when Martin McGuinness pulled the plug is because Stormont, the DUP, was not prepared to use the money that had been set aside to investigate state killings, in other words, army killings, which addresses Sinn Féin's agenda. And Sinn Féin and the IRA want to rewrite the history in their image, which causes even deeper resentment. And all these are part of the process, part of the deep feeling anger in the Unionist community that makes reconciliation and political progress more and more difficult. How you solve that, how you address it, I honestly don't know. I've never been in favour of a truth commission, because in terms of Northern Ireland and what I know of Northern Ireland, we know of Northern Ireland, I just can't see that working. I can't see the South African model working. Addressing the past, I mean, there are those who say, the past is past, let us move on. That's very easy to say, but not easy to say if you've lost loved ones, whatever side you're on. So, I mean, I don't know what the answer is, but it certainly explains the depth of feeling, in particular on the part of the Unionist community that feels besieged. And all the slogans that we're familiar with about no surrender, remember 1690, are coming to the fore again.
Can I just, on this point, though, because this again is something what Peter's talking about, which is relevant to a lot of the conflicts that you'll study, which is that the historically powerful community that has to give ground doesn't have the confidence to give the ground it needs to give. So that's one of the huge problems you have in Northern Ireland, is that Unionist confidence is very, very low. And so the things which I think historically need to be done, it's very difficult for them politically to do. Can I just respond to the point you made about identity and grievances? Because again, I think it's absolutely central to what you might take away from your visit to the North. You're right that the identities which are reinforced by conflict, and sometimes, as in Northern Ireland, are reinforced by the peace deal, are also the identities which produce the hostility from which the violence comes. But, and each case I think will be unique, but most of the cases in the world where you have different ethnic or religious groups living next door to each other are non-violent. The ones we study are the violent ones. Okay, the statistical overwhelming reality is that for the most part, people who are different live next to each other peacefully. So I wouldn't give up on the idea of different identities being peaceful, though it'll vary. What you identify in terms of grievances is the key. If people feel they've got grievances and they haven't got power and they haven't got legitimacy, then I think that business of identities will explode. But I think if you can address the idea of communities feeling that they're grievances are dealt with and that their identities are respected, then I think it's possible to live as neighbours and self-segment without violence occurring.
What,
does
and
the border question, we cross the border coming from Dublin, mm-hmm. does the border question have the potential of making things, well, explode, as you said it right now?
I think at the moment, undoubtedly, the reintroduction of the border question has reinforced the polarisation between the communities in Northern Ireland, and in particular, it's increased nationalist anger. We had a situation where most nationalists in Ireland, north and south, had for the moment come to terms with the idea of a flexible border, and that has now significantly changed. I don't think the conditions exist for a return to large-scale violence. But the border question has become a problem which has reinforced division and polarisation. And from a unionist point of view, unionists were much more likely to be in favour of Brexit, ironically, but a unionist favouring of Brexit has favoured something which has made nationalist acceptance of the border less calm. And it's a really, in my view, and I've said this to them, as unionists, it was a stupid thing to support Brexit because basically it's annoyed nationalists, it's brought the border back into politics, and it's made it less likely that unionists can have a comfortable nationalist community living with the border.
Deirdre would like to add something to these arguments, then your question afterwards.
I think Richard is exactly right when he says the border has come back to politics because of Brexit. And that is an issue. Will it lead to large-scale violence? No, I don't think so. I don't imagine it. But has it reopened old wounds? Yes, I believe it has. I believe that we were on a process, a fragile process of building peace, and this has come along and unsettled the whole process. And whilst we've had some recent extensive discussion around the customs union, around the single market, the impact on trade and the impact on the economy, what we have not had is the psychological impact of reintroducing a border in Ireland. It may seem like overstating it, but for many people, the return to a hard border or any sort of hardening of the border would be akin to the repartitioning of Ireland, particularly for people who live in border communities. For them, the invisible border means that they can freely identify with the Republic of Ireland, or, if they want, the north of Ireland. The invisible border is psychologically important to their identity. It's also a sign of progress, it's a sign of peace, and any move back would be regressive and retrospectively moving in the wrong direction. And I think it is important that there is some understanding of the emotion and the psychological feeling around a border. A border is designed to separate, and that's exactly what it does. And certainly the narratives in Northern Ireland would have been those people on the other side of the border. Those ones up there and them ones down there. We were different. We had very little in common. The border reinforced that separation, that difference of identity. We had, in the last two decades, entirely moved away from that type of discussion. People moved across that border freely. In fact, you didn't really know if you had crossed the border. And I think a lot of nationalist anger is when they hear cabinet ministers in London talking about a frictionless border, a seamless border, a creative border. And yet when they're asked what that looks like, they have absolutely no idea. Nor, it would seem, do they really care. And I think that is what is extraordinarily frustrating for the people of Ireland who feel, in a sense, haven't we suffered enough? Now you're going to impose something. It is important to say that the majority of people in Northern Ireland voted to remain in the European Union. We are very clear about the benefits of the European Union and what the European Union has done for us. So I think it is important to state that a lot of the anger is around the dismissive attitude of the British cabinet towards the Irish border. 2 weeks ago, David Davis, the Brexit secretary, said categorically there would be no cameras at the border. 1 week later, in front of the exiting the EU committee, he said he was considering number plate recognition. Well, what is he going to do it with? And it's that type of, oh, it'll be all right on the night. These people are upping their game. And also the way that the Irish government have been treated by the British press, where the Taoiseach is deemed to be the villain of the piece here, because he is standing up for the sovereign rights of the Republic of Ireland, and he is standing shoulder to shoulder with the EU 27. I think the way that debate has panned out has damaged international relations and damaged Anglo-Irish relations. At a time when Anglo-Irish relations probably were at their best, we now, and just to throw into the mix, we also have the DUP deal with the Conservative government, which has also shifted the political landscape in Northern Ireland, because we understood the Irish and British governments to be the honest brokers who would robustly support the Good Friday Agreement. Questions have to be asked about the British government's impartiality when they are dependent on the DUP to stay in power in London.
We have a question from Martin and then from Heidi. I'm quite surprised that we are talking around the circle in the sense that we are not talking about the root of all evil and core problems. Reconciliation can only happen if you don't continue segregated education, but then you are breeding another generation of segregated thinking and feeling young people. And I share the idea of Elham. There are other conflict areas in the world with pretty much the same problem. And last year in August, Martin Allard had a very prominent article in the Swiss radio SRF in August about what is changing in the Irish Republic. And I think we should think about how to solve the core problem before we are talking about the mechanics of probably dissolving Northern Ireland and integrating it into the Irish Republic.
But wouldn't it be fantastic if we had visionary local politicians who said, let's set aside our vested interests, yes, and let's decide that actually what we want are the best outcomes for every child that is born here. And I suppose if you look at Finland, for example, you can say, well, in the 1960s, they came out of the shadow of Russia, and they decided that education would be more important than anything else, and radically transformed the landscape. We do not have that caliber of visionary thinking. We don't have the politicians to do it, and I don't know who's going to force them.
But it's also important to be, I mean, I'm very sympathetic to the questioner's point of view, but you've also got to recognise that the two main parties in Northern Ireland, the DUP and Sinn Féin, have entirely different bases of support. Okay, Sinn Féin has basically no Protestant support, and the DUP has essentially no Catholic support. So while they say we're against sectarian division, they're actually not. Sectarian division is what means that they're in power and that they get their strength of support. So I think, though it sounds a cold thing, and I'm like Peter, I am an optimist about Northern Ireland, despite what I'm saying now, I am an optimist about Northern Ireland, but I think you have to be realistic. There is electorally absolutely no benefit for a Sinn Féiner to seem too much like they want to say, let's get rid of the Catholic teacher training college, let's get rid of the Catholic schools. They would be out of a job, okay? And there is no electoral benefit for the Democratic Unionist Party political class to be overly nice towards Irish nationalism. Now, I regret that that's the case, but I think those are the frameworks that we're working within, because you have two nationalisms with different views of which state should run the place, and that's not an uncommon problem. The much worse version of it in terms of global danger is Israel-Palestine, but it's the same essential problem. Where do you have the boundaries of the state to match the legitimacy of national aspiration? Both national aspirations entirely valid in terms of their own internal dynamics. But I think that there is no likelihood of that kind of erosion. The best you're going to get is what Deirdre was referring to, which is that two rival communities can live peacefully with the deal that we have. And then in the future, you might get a dissolution. You might have other kinds of reconciliation emerging. The reason I'm optimistic is because of the scale of this conflict set against some of the other ones. Okay, if you compare this to the former Yugoslavia, if you compare this to Iraq, if you compare this to Syria, the level of sustenance of normal civil society in Northern Ireland is remarkable. So we do have problems, but I think they're ones which would seem comparatively mild if we were comparing this to a conversation in Iraq or a conversation certainly in Syria.
The way that my fellow English citizens see Northern Ireland, one of the questions that I've been asked down the years by my English friends is, but why don't they have integrated education? Surely that's the answer. Well, yes, it is, but it's not simple. And I remember when I started reporting Northern Ireland way back in the early 1970s, this struck me. This is nonsense. This is nonsense because as long as you have separate educations, then you have separate versions of history. History is taught from the Protestant Unionist point of view in the Protestant schools, and Irish nationalist Republican history is taught basically in the Catholic schools. But the fact that after all these years, 40, 45 years, the education system is still segregated is an utter, utter disgrace. And now, Deirdre, I'm sure, will correct me, and I think that the current percentage of integrated schools is something like 6%. Yeah. It's still very, very small. That is just disgraceful. But...
Well, I think you just made the point I wanted to make. The common history mm-hmm. books mm-hmm. is one of the issues. And I was just wondering, there are some examples, remarkable examples, for example, in Poland. How do you report on an event that happened in the Second World War, famous Katyn mm-hmm. murder case, mm-hmm. which the Soviets incriminated to the Nazi, but in fact it was the Soviets who committed it. And there was a couple of years ago a commission which started to write a common history. It was not possible, but they could. They wrote each chapter by a Russian and a Polish, but the introduction and the conclusion was written by a joint statement. And I think these are some steps that can be envisaged. I believe history is extremely important, not to perpetrate myths and legends and undigested history events.
People often forget, certainly on the English side of the Irish Sea, that this conflict is a tripartite conflict. It's not just about Catholics be Protestants or nationalists be Unionists. It's essentially about our role, the British role, in the conflict. Mm. So there are three sides to it. And how do we, the English, or the non-Irish part of the United Kingdom, how do we also, A, report, and B, record the history of this conflict? And I think if you read different histories compiled by different elements of those three different parties to the conflict, you'll find not a lot of common ground. Not a lot of common ground, and that again is part of the problem. How we perceive our history and how our histories combined affect where we are now and where we're likely to go.
But also in the Polish case, the Poles can agree that both the Soviets and the Germans were the villains. So it's a different thing. And I think that what we have here is a rival set of, for example, if you're talking about the Northern Ireland conflict, the Unionist community and the Nationalist community and people in England would have very different views of why it started, who was to blame mm-hmm. for keeping it going, and why it ended. And although, academics can agree on a lot, there's still, as Peter suggests, there's still an awful lot of disagreement between academics and journalists with different sides. I do think, though, that it's unlikely that an agreed history curriculum mm-hmm. is going to solve this. The truth of the matter is people want to be in separate schools.
I think it is important, though, to say that, of course, it's significant in terms of history, but it's also, it permeates throughout the curricula. Mm. So you will have different English textbooks.
Yeah.
You will have different poetry. You will not have Irish poetry in Protestant schools, not to the same extent. So it's not just about the history. It's about the English. It's about the culture. Mm. There are different Bibles. Even in science, there are different interpretations of when the world developed, how the world developed. So, yes, history is important. But that difference in terms of identity and what you believe and what happened in the past permeates throughout the whole of the school curriculum and, of course, into the sport. Mm. So some schools will have GAA, some will not. Some will have cricket, some will not. So it's the whole culture of the school. If it were just history, that would be one thing. But I think it is important to understand that it's the whole shebang.
Now I have three questions and we have 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. We have four questions and we have 15 minutes. So the shorter the question is, the shorter the answer is, mm-hmm. the better it is for all of us. So Coach Beanon, please.
I just would like to share an observation with you. I think there are two entirely different classes of problems of conflicts we have to deal with. So-called political problems are different views about concepts of societies and the structure of problems and the structure of solutions. There you can argue rationally. But as soon as identity comes into play, then you have a much different structure of problems. Emotions come in, they have much deeper roots. Emotions cannot be tackled by intellectual insight. They have to be dealt with on an emotional basis. It's not clear how. You remember in South Africa, the Committee of Truth, or what was it called? That was a kind of a search for a common denominator. And I think the way to a solution of these problems where identities, they are basically of a tribal nature. The way to a solution of these identity problems is by looking for a common denominator. Mm-hmm. Where do we find a common denominator? And to work
thank you. We take this as a statement, not as a question. Mm-hmm. Okay, all right. Then we have a question from Stefan, please.
I have another question.
Will you put on your microphone?
Oh, sorry. I understand. Is this okay?
We can hear you.
Okay. Understand that there is a certain hope of the young generation having a different attitude to the whole situation. The young generation, as you have said, of your children, maybe on both sides there is a hope that the young generation will sort of get a certain distance from all these problems. They have a different world now. And my question is, of course, if this is not only on your side, or it's on both sides, the same thing, and if the generation of the people who march, the Protestant who march through the Catholic quarters of Belfast will sort of be in the end a march of old people. I mean, is there any chance of the young generation developing a different attitude? Because from what I have heard until now, I think this is the only hope. Because
they are still maybe open to some.
Let's make it short because we are.
Okay.
I'll say one thing very quickly. If you look at a Protestant band parade, which is about to start here in Belfast and around Northern Ireland, the number of young people, 5, 6, 7, 8, the number of children who are being brought up with that culture is quite remarkable. And it just indicates how deep the problem goes.
It is, but I don't want to prolong this, but there is also the issue of class that we haven't discussed. We haven't had the chance to discuss. But it is important to say that the working classes were disproportionately affected by the Troubles. And there are 50% of the people in Northern Ireland who do not vote. And there are many people who live in Northern Ireland who are uninterested in local politics, who can get along very nicely, thank you very much. They tend to be relatively well off. House prices are cheap. You will see around Belfast, restaurants are booming. We're building new hotels. There's a different side to this story, and that's the people who are more middle class have actually divested themselves of any engagement with local politics. They just basically say, a plague on all their houses. Get on with it, because they have never made a single policy decision in Northern Ireland that has affected these people. But it is dangerous to have half the population disengaged.
Martin?
Just that you were talking a lot about polarisation in society and it getting worse. So I thought it was perhaps worthwhile taking back a step in terms of conflict resolution, and noting that the Good Friday Agreement was concluded between the more moderate parties in Northern Ireland, the SDLP, the Moderate Nationalists, and the UUP, who had failed 20 years earlier in exactly the same experiment. They were brave because they had to defend their courage against opportunist radical voices on either side, Sinn Féin and the DUP, who were shouting, sell out, sell out. And then when the Good Friday Agreement was there was a process that lasted, correct me if I'm wrong, 5 years until 2003, when those moderate parties were crushed at elections by the more radical voices, who became bigger and bigger and biggest. And of course, physics would dictate that in that process, those two formerly radical parties became more moderate themselves because they swallowed a little bit of moderate ground. But they were still shrill voices. And Seamus Mallon, for whom I have the greatest of respect, said in 2003, when the two radical parties had crushed their moderate rivals, that this will lead to a feudalisation of Ireland. Those two parties will treat their electoral areas as clients. And as you have explained, that implies an incapability of coming to compromises between the two sides. Now, what do you do in that situation? The process, if you agree with my analysis, process has happened. We are in the entrenched situation now. What does politics do?
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right that what's happened is that a deal that was done by parties near the middle has organisationally benefited the parties further to the outside. But as you rightly hint, those parties have effectively become much more like the parties in the middle. So 30 years ago, what Sinn Féin students and constitutional nationalist students would have been saying would have been very different. What Sinn Féin students now are saying sounds very much like what the SDLP used to say 30 years ago. So there's been a taking over organisationally, but wearing different clothes. The question behind your question is, could it have been better? Now, the SDLP, Seamus Mallon in particular, has argued that if the British government had supported the middle ground more during negotiations, they could have been protected. But another way of looking at it, which I know people in London in government have seen it as, is it doesn't matter whether you've got the DUP, Sinn Féin, the SDLP or the UUP in power. What matters is no one's blowing anything up. And I think there is an argument from hard-headedness for that. I agree with you. What you've got is a polarization and a sort of thinning out of the middle ground. But the extreme parties have become much less extreme. If you look at what the SDLP was saying in 1974, 1984, it sounds very like Sinn Féin in 2018. So there are optimistic ways of reading this as well.
Thank you very much. That's called the poison chalice, I think. That was an argument that, you know, I heard and made a film about way back in the 1970s. You know, a plague on all their houses. Why are we involved? Why are we losing our soldiers? Why are we spending all this money? They don't deserve it. They're just mad Irish. They kill each other. Nothing to do with us. Let's pull the plug and get out of it. Right? That was a very simple but gut reaction. And that's what a lot of English people felt in the 70s and 80s. To a lesser extent, that was felt when the sort of peace process began to get underway and bear fruit. But that is not going to happen. That is not going to happen for the very simple reason that there are a million Protestants here in Northern Ireland who are British citizens, who regard themselves as being British, and no British government that I can see, not even Jeremy Corbyn, friend of Gerry Adams and other revolutionaries, are going to pull the plug because, you know, morally they can't, politically they can't, and it just isn't going to happen. So what the British government is going to have to do is stick to it, push where necessary, as it did over Good Friday and the ceasefire and everything else, and hang on in there and play its part, because this Northern Ireland is part of the United Kingdom, and therefore we have a huge responsibility to see this process through. However long it takes, and it will take an awful long time, and however much it costs, we've just got to hang on in there and see it through. And that's why, in the end, I'm optimistic, not in terms of time frame, time scales, but in terms of, you know, an eventual, not total resolution, but the creation of a society in which people can live in peace. And I come back to what I said at the very beginning. The crucial thing is the peace is a peace without large-scale violence.
Yeah, but if I think back to what Deirdre said at the beginning, she said, well, there is sort of negligence from the side of the British government in London. I mean, as long as you have this situation, things do not change.
I think on the idea that Britain would just say enough, that would lead to a civil war. And wherever you live, I'll come and live where you live, and you can come and live in my house. Okay, right. But on the negligence, I mean, Deirdre and I are in agreement on this. London should be far more involved than it is. I mean, we've got Jeremy Corbyn is coming to the university that I work at in a couple of weeks' time. We can't get the Prime Minister to come and talk about Brexit. So there is negligence. I don't think that's going to cause civil war. But if you try to accelerate political change too fast in Northern Ireland, that's what you'll get. And as I say, you've got an offer to swap houses with me.